Hi, I'm Stacey Shoemaker-Rowan, Editor-in-Chief of Hospitality Design Magazine, with HD's What I've Learned podcast. Today, I got to talk to Paula Scher, partner at multidisciplinary design practice, Pentagram. Her career is as wide-ranging as it is inspirational. The former art student who pivoted to graphic design is also a children's book author. She's designed album covers for artists like John Prine. She launched her own magazine with Terry Koppel, and she became the first female partner at Pentagram. Among her many clients, her indelible work has transformed the Public Theater in New York, where she learned many lessons over the course of an almost 30-year relationship. Paula is not afraid of making mistakes, or as she describes it, being a little bit ignorant where asking a quote-unquote stupid question may reveal an unusual way of seeing something. Though she has sometimes felt like a misfit, she sees that as another way of rebelling against the belief of what she's supposed to be. From the beginning, she says, I have tried to defy expectations. Hi, I'm here with Paula. Paula, thanks so much for joining me today.
Glad to be here.
So we always start at the beginning. Where did you grow up? And did you always have a love of design, or were you creative-minded growing up?
I was. I liked to draw. I was born in Washington, D.C. My father worked for the government. I lived until I was seven in Falls Church, Virginia. And then we moved to Silver Spring, Maryland, but it's all around the Washington, D.C. area. And I drew so much that when I was about 12 years old, my parents sent me to the Corcoran School of Art in Washington to take drawing and painting classes on weekends. And I did that all through high school, which was very bizarre. High school students didn't do that, but I really liked the environment. And I think it was the first place I really felt comfortable.
I've read a previous interview where you said you were pretty terrible at everything in art school. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, in high school, it was unusual being good at art. And I was the publicity chairman of the school. And there was a high school teacher named Mr. Tucker, who had a little box outside the art room with a glass cover, and he had something called Picture of the Week. And I used to work really hard to get Picture of the Week, and I have them a lot. I think I have them the most of anybody one year, and I was the school artist. And then when I went to art school, everybody was the school artist. And of the school artists, I was really low down on the list. they were better than me. They had better drawing skills. People were better painters. I was terrible in crafts and sculpture. I mean, I was sloppy. I didn't know how to control anything. As a matter of fact, in my first 2 years of school, where you took every sort of discipline you had to, I really felt like I was terrible until I got into something called graphic design. And graphic design, I thought it was going to be like the basic design I took, where the major goals seemed to be you moved a black square around a white page, and you had to glue it down with rubber cement. And my rubber cement always oozed out of the sides and was rather, you know, disgusting. So in my sophomore year, when I took graphic design, it wasn't about that at all. It was about ideas. And you made things like posters, and you made book jackets, and you expressed ideas for other topics. And I was good at it. So I stayed with it. Do what you do best.
Yeah, exactly. Were your parents creative, or it's just amazing that they pushed you, you know, to this art school?
No, they didn't push me to the art school. I pushed me to the art school. I fought and screamed and cried until I got my way.
Oh, there you go.
It's just the truth. I also went out and got a student defense loan, which they took to pay for it, which they then felt guilty and paid for it. It was like, I sort of skipped over that part. No, this is the thing I could do. Nobody thought I knew what I was doing, least of all me, but I knew what I was doing. And years later, I thought, well, how could I have not done that? But when I got to art school, the shock was I wasn't the best in art. Sort of near the bottom, I'd say.
Well, look at you now. And so did you continue graphic design through college?
Yes, I majored in it. And I had an amazing teacher named Stanislaw Zagorski, who for whom I owe so much. He found the parts of me that were really functioning and encouraged them. I thought I wanted to be an illustrator. As a matter of fact, my major in graphic design was really on the illustration side, because I didn't understand how to work with typography. In those days, you know, there weren't computers, and I worked with press type, which was the technology of the day, and you rub this thing down on the corners of book jackets, and invariably my type did not line up, and it was plastic, and it cracked, and it flipped off the page, and I was sloppy, and I couldn't control it, and I hated typography because of it, because I thought that's what type was rubbing something down on the corner of a design. And my teacher, who had a very thick Polish accent, said, "Illustrate with type." And those three words made my entire career. It took me a couple of weeks to figure out what he meant. But when I figured it out, I knew it, because I realized that typography had form and it could be expressive, and that you could accompany it with words and it would imbue the words with a kind of meaning that you didn't expect that would be memorable. And that's what I do.
That's amazing. And what did you do right after school? What was your first kind of foray into the field?
Well, Mr. Zagorski, when I think of him, I don't think of him as Stanislaw Zagorski, I think of him as Mr. Zagorski, made appointments for me in New York. And I met art directors, and I met my future husband that way, Seymour Quast, who owned his partners with Milton Glaser in a business called Pushpin. And I met him with my portfolio in 1970. But Mr. Zagorski got on the phone and called up people, and he drove me to New York in his Ferrari, which he had. He drove with one finger on it at about 90 miles an hour. It took us an hour to get to New York. I was terrified. I remember that. he mentored me, and I owe him a great deal.
That's amazing. And so you started to work for CBS Records then?
No, I had a lot of different jobs. I was half illustrating. I wrote a children's book, illustrated it. The children's book was lost. Then another illustrator, I showed him the text for the children's book, and he wanted it illustrated, a man named Stan Mack. And he took it to a publisher at Pantheon Books, and it was published when I was, I think, 23 years old.
That's amazing. What was the book about?
It's still in print. It's called The Brownstone. Oh. It was in Random House had it for about 25 years. Then it finally went out of print. And then Princeton, who is my current publisher, just republished it a couple of years ago. It still sells. It's still on Amazon. It gets good reviews. It was written when I first moved to New York. So it was about brownstone that a bunch of animals lived in. And the provocateur is sort of the protagonist, I should say, is a bear. It's a bear family that's hibernating for the winter, and a kangaroo moves in next door and they're taking dancing lessons. So it provokes this series of moves. And I had illustrated the book really when I sold the idea of it. I never really wrote a text. I had a series of diagrams which sort of told you what the action was and how they had to resolve their problems in this communal living situation. So there were starving mice and feasting pigs, and they lived next door to each other in the end. And there was an opera singing cat who got together with the kangaroos and formed a nightclub act. It was very silly like that, but it was a beautiful book that Stan Mack illustrated with these cutaways of the inside of the apartment building, so you can see where all the animals moved.
That's so cool. What made you want to, was that something you'd always wanted to do, or did you just do that as a creative?
I went around to see different art directors and publishers, and half of my portfolio at that time was illustration, and the other half was design. So depending upon the person I saw, I pulled out a different part of work. So I was showing an editor of children's books, children's book illustrations. And he said, if you want to illustrate a children's book, the best thing to do is to write one. So I went home and wrote one. I kind of did things like that. I know it sounds very flip, but I think it was the naivety of my real limitations were, or what the expectations of me would do. He told me to write one. I had an idea for it. I got the idea somewhere. I don't remember where. I just had it. Right. And then I diagrammed it out and I illustrated a couple pages for it, wrote a brief manuscript, and then gave it to this publisher who lost both. He was a Doubleday. He lost both the manuscript and the illustrations and never could find them. He just kept them on his desk. And I had no expectation that he should find them. You know, like, I mean, this is like complete naivety about the industry, though it was a naive industry at the same time to a degree, not as professionalized as it is now. And then later, I got a job designing the insides of children's books at Random House. And I worked for Pantheon and Knopfkiss because the children's books were sort of all one central location. And I was really doing paste ups and mechanicals. And Stan Mack, who, if you ever saw The Village Voice and the Real Life Funnies, he was actually a fairly big illustrator at the time, and he was hanging around. Like, he used to go into my little cubicle and smoke cigarettes because you couldn't smoke anywhere else, and I was a smoker. So he would go into the cubicle and smoke cigarettes and talk to me, and he was doing work for an editor there named Jane Fader, illustrating children's books. I told him about mine that got lost. And he said, well, tell me the story. And I told him the story, and I drew this little diagram of what happened with the animals. And he says, I'll sell it for you if you let me illustrate it. I said, sure. So I gave it to him, and he took it around the corner, and he sold it to Jane Fader. And that's how the book got published.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. That doesn't happen. It was just a bizarro, fluky thing when I was a kid.
That's awesome. So did you like illustrating for children's books? And
I was terrible at it. I stunk as an illustrator. When I married Seymour and you know, I saw the way he could work and draw and think and paint and do, I knew I couldn't do that. I was terrible. I was really terrible at virtually everything, just like art school all over again. I sort of succeeded by finding this really narrow thing that I do, doing it really well and sticking to it. And when I foray off into other areas, I usually have enormous flops. So that's what I've learned about myself. It's like sort of stick to things I do well and expand on them a little bit at a time, but always try to expand on it, but not go into some other area that I can't do well.
Got it. And what would you call, how do you describe what you do well?
I understand how to be expressive with typography.
Okay.
And I understand how to imbue things with meaning to make them recognizable. So that's where it works very well in situations like branding, where you're essentially differentiating everything.
Right.
And I managed, because of my affinity for typography, when I learned how to do environmental graphics. Originally, I was, you know, putting large typography in public spaces, which was radical at the moment because nobody else was doing it. Then it became commonplace, and so then they started to get built dimensionally. But I still work in a narrow format. The thinking is driven by the same impulses, and I began painting in the same way. You know, I don't have a broad. You know, I don't suddenly paint landscapes or figures. I paint maps, and the maps are really type. It's narrow.
It's narrow, but it's, I mean, like you said, do what you do well, do or best. And so how long, you also, before you started your own firm though, you did work with CBS Records for a bit, right? Doing record covers and posters. Yeah. What was that like?
Crazy. I feel that I'm supposed to tell a story about working really hard and having successes, but it didn't happen like that. A lot of things were just accidental. I got into the record industry after Random House when I was doing the inside of the children's books because my boss, at Random House, an art director named Herb Levitt was leaving his job, and he felt bad for me because he thought that the person that they would hire, he thought I was such a nut job that the person who would inherit me would probably fire me. So he wanted to find me an appropriate place to live. And he called his pal, Ted Bernstein, who ran the advertising department of the record industry, and I asked him if he had a spot for me. And he said, I really like this girl. She's terrific. But she has no experience at all in what you're doing over there, and but she'll pick it up really fast. And he hired me just on Herb Levitt's say-so. And a very, I would say, non-convincing portfolio. And I began working, designing ads for records. And this is where I learned everything about politics in working in that little advertising department. I understood how people made decisions. And I started to figure out how things got made. Like, for example, I used to design ads for magazines like Cashbox and Billboard. And you'd be doing, say, an ad for a Bruce Springsteen album. And the ad would go to the copy chief for approval. I would write it with the copywriter. There was a copywriter assigned to me. It was a fellow named Marty Picar, who was terrific. And we'd work together, and we'd come up with an idea for advertising and copy, and we'd go to the copy director. And then the copy director would generally reject it, and we'd come back, and we'd make changes. And then it would go from the copy director to the creative director of the department, and he would generally reject something, and then we'd go back, and we'd fix it and make changes. And it would be like that until Monday was over. On Wednesday, the ad closed. So what I discovered was that it would take a week for it to hit. It would take 3 days from Monday to Wednesday to get every approval. So whatever was approved on Wednesday made it through. So I just stopped designing the ads on Monday because I realized you just had to do them on Wednesday and they would go right through and you would have you'd get better ads produced because nobody had any time to mess around with it because it was the end of the week. They always made it worse. So this was sort of a learning curve about how people make decisions. I also learned that most people are afraid of their bosses. So whatever their boss says will be correct. So it doesn't matter what they say. It really matters what the immediate person over them says if they have the final say. And if they don't have the final say, it doesn't matter what they say either. And this is still true. This is why I never like working for middle management, because they actually don't have authority to say things.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So it's sort of like I look at those 2.5 years I worked in that department as really beginning to understand how corporations function.
Right.
I know I sound sort of snide about it, but in fact, this is true.
Yeah.
And in that department, I did, I think Marty and I did some very good ads. Some of them won awards. I mean, we began doing them. Some of them were very funny. The art director of Atlantic Records saw them, and he had an opening in his department, and it was really, it would have been a lateral move, except his department also produced record covers. So it meant if I took that job, I could work on record covers, which I would have preferred to the advertising. So that's how I started doing record covers. I went to Atlantic Records. I designed 25 covers the year I was there. And some of them won awards. And CBS Records, the cover department, called me back, and I became East Coast Art Director.
Are there any covers that stick out to you as some of your favorite?
Well, Atlantic Records, I did Mingus 1 and 2 in 1974. And the albums are classics. And when they were moved to CDs, when I designed that record covers, they were 12 and a quarter by 12 and a quarter inches. The Mingus covers, when they moved to CDs, they were so respectful of the album cover, they never reduced the size. They folded it up at the full cover size and shoved it into the vinyl and plastic, whatever that stuff was that you shoved, printed pieces of paper into. And it was really lovely because, these other art directors did it long after I'd left. The graphic was so recognizable that you could recognize a corner of it.
That's amazing.
So it's sort of amazing. And you know, I'm trying to think the other things I was proud of. A John Prine album called Common Sense. It was, I think, really good of its kind. I did a lot of jazz, which is what Atlantic had, and I continued that at CBS. But at CBS, I did many more record covers. A lot of them are terrible, but a lot of them weren't.
How much back and forth did you have with the artists back then?
They all had contractual cover approval.
Okay.
You know, the only time you didn't meet with recording artists was either when they were dropped with the label and they still had a contract to produce the album, or they were dead. I loved working with dead recording artists. they
had less opinions.
Yeah. Sometimes they had living managers. That was difficult.
That's true.
I liked a lot of the bands I worked with them, and a lot of it was really fun. I didn't realize what a terrific job I had. I was always working. I worked very late. I was very productive, but I didn't know until many years later that what my early existence was like as a graphic designer was highly unusual and not really replicable.
Right.
You know, and I see how young designers develop today, and it's a totally different scenario.
Yeah. I mean, I guess hindsight's always easier, right?
Well, you walk into your adulthood in the political framework of the times. Your understanding of design history and what you think is good and bad and the way you make value judgments is very much formed by the time you walk in the door. And a lot of it's shaped by your politics. So that your whole worldview is actually quite narrow, because it's maybe based on your social proclivities that were developed in late high school and college. I mean, how much knowledge is there? So that you're prejudiced without knowledge, and then you go and you relearn all of history year by year until you broaden.
Very true. And were you immersed in the music scene? You know, was that part, or were you just working kind of in tandem of the music scene?
I was not terribly immersed, I can't say. I mean, there were recording artists I really loved, but I didn't necessarily do their covers. And I did a lot of jazz albums, and I didn't develop an appreciation for jazz until years later. Yeah. I worked with a jazz fusion artist named John McLaughlin. I think I did four or five covers from him. And he was originally a Hare Krishna with a shaved head and little cymbals, and came in a pink robe. And he insisted that I listen to his album and watch me listen to it. And he used to lock the door to my office and play it. And it was like torture, because I hated fusion jazz at that point. And then 3 years later, I remember he came in and he had let his hair grow, and he had this incredibly beautiful brown leather jacket on, and he was tall and gorgeous. And he walked into my office and said, "I'm into materialism." And it was fantastic. He had just completely changed. But then he played the same fusion album, and I was furious.
Too funny. What made you decide to leave that world and start your own firm?
Well, there were a lot of factors, but you know, I was there for a long time, and I made about a mile of record covers. I wanted to design things that weren't square. I wanted to broaden. But mostly the record industry had been in trouble. The late 80s, there was the Carter recession, you know, like Reagan had just been elected president in 82. Carter was 76, maybe he's 80. I'm trying to remember the politics of things, but the politics were sort of changing. The record industry had been gone from being sort of wild and crazy and wealthy to austere, but the worst thing was CDs were coming in. And that meant that my work shrunk. And not only did it shrink, but it went behind plastic. And I thought, okay, I really have to make a move. The problem was I didn't have any experience doing anything else. So I took a studio. At that time, I was getting a lot of freelance book jackets, because book jacket publishers discovered that record business people did good book jackets, because they're sort of similar translatable thing. And I would get calls from independent recording artists at the same time to do their work. So I took an office space And by pure coincidence, the Stones came around and they wanted me to do their summer, their touring album.
Very cool.
So I moved into this new space and the first client that came to see me was Mick Jagger and the whole office went wild. I'll never forget that. That's sort of strange. And I did that for about 6 months. And then I was given a contract by Time Magazine to develop a new magazine for them because they thought it would be fun to hire somebody with no magazine experience. They thought they'd get, oh, they get some interesting take.
Right.
So I developed one publication for them. And then they gave me another when that didn't test well. And they decided to develop that publication to launch, and I had no magazine experience and I didn't really know how to launch a magazine. So a friend of mine named Terry Coppell, who was working up at the Boston Globe, he was a friend of mine from college, had moved to New York. So I asked him to come and work with me because I needed somebody with magazine experience to help me launch this thing. So we were locked up, literally locked up in a top secret room in magazine development in Time Inc. And We got along so well that we started a company.
Amazing.
He died recently. He died a couple of weeks ago. It was a lot of fun. It was really scary. And it was, for a number of years, very successful.
Yeah. What was the magazine that you launched?
Oh, it was called Together. And it was a magazine about relationships.
Interesting.
It was actually a stupid magazine. It didn't deserve to succeed. I'll tell you why they were interested in the magazines, because Henry Grunwald was editor-in-chief of Time Inc. in those days, and he liked me, and I had to do a mock-up for a cover. They had no cover story, and I took a girlfriend of mine who was very attractive and took a picture of her and put her on the cover, and it said, "Why hasn't this woman had a date in 10 years?" And it was about sort of the difficulties of what, and he was so taken with that headline that he wanted to publish that magazine. But in fact, that woman hadn't had a date in nearly 10 years because she just couldn't connect with anybody. Married man with kids, but you know, at that point in time, she hadn't. And it was the basis for a magazine that didn't really exist. Then they didn't know what to do with it.
That's too funny. What did you learn about creating, you know, as a magazine editor? What was it that you liked or didn't like about that whole process of launching a magazine?
Oh, I can't say that there was something about the process. I mean, it was really the way Time Inc. At that period of time went about magazine launches. They developed and tested, and they never could get anything off the ground. Where right. Condé Nast, you know, launched Vanity Fair and Public at the same time, failing with like the first 2 or 3 years until they finally had a success. So right. Instead of dickering around in private and testing, they made something and worked it until it became successful.
Right.
I mean, it just seemed that the timing method may have appeared to be more scientific, but it didn't seem like you could actually come out with something new and automatically gain readership. No. You would have to develop it. It would have to grow.
Right. Especially then, you know, without...
without social media or any of the other...
Exactly. What else did you two work on before you went over to Pentagram?
Well, Terry and I were in business together for 7 years, so we did lots of different things together. We essentially did not collaborate all that much. We had two basic books of business: editorial design, which was his book of business, and promotional advertising and covers and some identity, which were my book of business. And when we first started the business, we got large very quickly because the former president of CBS, a man named Bruce Lundvall, went to Capitol and started Manhattan Records and also Blue Note. So Blue Note was started, but he picked up and reemerged the label. So we did work for both. We had that contract for the first 2 years we were in business, and all of a sudden we had 17 employees, which
oh, wow.
We did. It was big, and then it shrunk very fast when the account went away.
Right.
So they cut down on Blue Note, and then we kept Manhattan for a while, and then that sort of tanked and got merged into Capitol and then came back. I mean, it's still around. It's sort of amazing how these things go up and down.
Yeah.
And the work I got after after the record industry was youth-related things like Swatch Watch when they first came to the United States, or this candy store I did called Ula that was Swedish, that was in shopping malls for a period of time, things like that. In the late 80s, I guess around 1989, it was the first Bush recession. There was a giant recession before Clinton was elected. And our business was decimated. Terry lost every magazine because magazines and recessions do terribly. And he really didn't have any billing for, I don't know, maybe a good half a year. And we just renovated a space and fixed it up. And so we were cash poor going into the recession. And he took a job, and I ended up running the business on my own. And I have this big space, and I was renting some of the space out to other people. And during that period, Woody Pirtle and Kid Heinrichs from Pentagram came over and asked me what I was doing and if I would want to join. And that's when they invited me.
What was it about Pentagram that you liked that made you want to go work for them or with them?
Well, I liked that the designers there seemed to earn a living while I was actually having a distinct difficulty at it. No, I have to tell you about that year and a half on my own. It was, yes, was debilitating. When I started the business, I was in my early 30s. Like when Terry and I were working at Time, I was about, I don't know, 31. And by the time we started Coppell and Share, which was the name of the business, I think I was 33 or 34. I don't really remember quite the age range. And I was still getting youth-oriented work. And the problem was that as the decade wore on in the 80s, I started competing with people younger and younger than me who were entering the field. And I found that particularly after Terry left and I was a woman alone in business, that I was getting the same work I had already gotten. And the kind of work I was getting was not going up higher in fees. It was more or less the same. And I had the distinct feeling that if I didn't make a definite change, it would go down. So when the offer came to join this group of men, and they were a big group of men, I thought I'd make more money. Also, their work was good. It was very high level. Pentagram had an amazing international reputation. And Michael Beirut, who was already a friend of mine, was asked to join at the same time. He joined 6 months earlier than me because I had to close down my business. But that also made it easier knowing I was going to have a friend walking in the door.
Right. And as you mentioned, you were the only partner that was a woman. How did that influence you as a leader? And, you know, did you face a lot of challenges in that role?
Yep. you have to realize that the partnership in the New York office wasn't so terrible. It was 5 guys. The London guys were 15.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess there were 10, there were 15 men all together when I went to my first partner's dinner. So I remember the first partners meeting I went to was in Rome, and we were staying at the Roman Academy, American Academy in Rome. And I remember we all went out to dinner, and there were, you know, 15 men and me, and they sort of had a big table that was sort of in a circle, and I had my little seat. And one of the either the hostess or somebody who was guiding us to the seats said to Alan Fletcher and 2 other men who she was talking to, she said, "Why is there only one woman here?" And Alan Fletcher said, "Oh, she was the only one who was talented enough to join our group." And she looked at me very snidely and said, "Oh, you must be very, very talented." You know, and I remember just feeling like, oh God, it's bad any way I look at it. You know, yeah, like this thing is like completely wrong. And there were other moments, and they all seem to have to do with these circular situations where I remember there was one dinner where I got up at the partners meeting and went to sit outside. And I sat outside and one of the partners came and sat with me. And there were two of us sitting in chairs. And there was a whole pile of chairs next to the building. And we were sort of sitting in a park-like area. And then a third person came out and pulled up a chair. And then a fourth person, fifth person, they kept coming out and pulling out chairs. And it was sort of fine because it was nice out. And then I got up to go to the ladies' room. And I came back and I saw the circle of 15 men sitting around with one chair empty. And I thought, I don't want to go over there and sit down. I just went upstairs and went to sleep. There were sort of these moments of it where it was just too much to handle. But one-on-one, it was never bad.
Yeah.
You know, I had my own relationships with people I was closer to and people I wasn't closer to. And that's still the truth today.
Yeah. And how do you elevate women today in the graphic design industry? Has that become something you either have pushed for or, you know, inadvertently pushed for?
I think both.
Yeah.
I mean, for a long time, I was an example, you know, like that. And in a very insulting way, like you'd get a call saying, and this goes back to even the late 70s, where somebody would call me up and say, we'd like you to speak at the AIGA, you know, Oshkosh lecture thing. And it's really hard to get women speakers. You know, so you're kind of invited and insulted at the same time, you know, and there was a lot of that went on for years. That there was, you know, I mean, I was always teaching. So I had so many women students that have become successful. Not that they were given more attention than the men students or, you know, that there was any even thought about it. It was more that they could see me as an example. So that made it possible for them to do it.
Right.
And that's really how. I mean, two of the, I have three women partners in the New York office and two women partners in the London office. So there's six women now. And one of the partners, Natasha Jen, used to be my intern. You know, and that makes me very proud that she did that. And another one, Emily Oberman, who had her own practice, was a very close girlfriend before she joined. And so that, you know, that there, you know, you can help as much as is warranted. You know, that you know, it isn't that that is something I'm going to do every day and get up and say, okay, I'm going to make it easier for women. But by virtue of the fact that you exist, you do that.
Yep. Very, very true. I feel like you'd be an amazing teacher. Do you love teaching?
No, you know, yeah, I do. I've been teaching for years. I've been teaching in total for 37 years.
Yeah.
This year, because of, sort of being shocked by Black Lives Matter, I am starting a scholarship program at CCNY and teaching the senior portfolio course I taught for 37 years at the School of Visual Arts and never realizing they never had a scholarship program. So I had four Black students in 37 years. That's pretty depressing.
Oh, wow.
Of course, they're famous. It's Gail Anderson and Bobby Martin are two of them. I mean, they're like the most well-known practitioners of in that capacity, but I mean, I've had four in 37 years.
Yeah.
And that's pretty grim.
So how's the scholarship program? Is it new? Is it something
that's... We're starting it this fall. Emily, Natasha and I are teaching it together.
Oh, that's amazing.
So we're doing it. We're going to be selecting the students this summer and starting it at Pentagram. I taught my SBA class at Pentagram. I used to teach on Monday nights. So I think I'll do the same thing.
That's great. How many students are you hoping for?
Well, we want to take 30, 10 per class. And the hope is that the skills are there and they can either become, you know, interns at Pentagram or be mentored to work at other good places and build careers.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's good. I hope.
Yeah.
I hope.
You're also a prolific artist. Your work has been in MoMA, Cooper Hewitt, Victoria and Albert, which is beyond amazing. How does your artistry inform your work at Pentagram, or how has this been an outlet for you?
I started painting in the year I was working on the Citibank logo. I had designed this corporate logo and I had to prove it a million times and design all these little iterations of things that one does when you do that kind of corporate identity. And I felt like at that period of time, I wasn't really creating anything or working with my hands very much like I used to. So I had, before I started painting the maps large, I used to paint satirical small maps. As a matter of fact, the Perez Museum in Florida, the collectors there, the Sackner family, had collected one of my small painted maps, and they use it to promote the museum as well as the fact that it's in the museum. And they gave me my start. Like after they purchased it, I thought, I really should do something with this. So I was up in the country on weekends, and Seymour, my husband, is a very prolific artist, and I wasn't doing much of anything. And I thought, you know, I bet this map would look good, great big. And I started painting these things bigger, and they got bigger and bigger. And in the process of doing it, I found these visual languages. And I had a friend who came up and saw them and showed them to his gallery. He was an artist, and he showed them to his gallery, and they gave me a show. So I began exhibiting them. And then we began making prints from them. And now I have a painting gallery and a print gallery and some collectors. And it's a real practice. And my view is that I'm me, but the professions have different rules. So that I conduct my business as a designer like a designer, and I conduct my business as a painter like a painter. And that the difference is that as a designer, you are in a social position where you are working collaboratively with clients, and the clients are hiring you for a specific fee to do a specific thing that you are going to influence and impact, that they're hiring for you as a consultant because of your expertise in the area, and that you're going to fulfill your obligations to that fee, and you're going to, through that collaboration, deliver them the work that is supposed to be delivered. And that there is nothing that says anything about quality in that condition. So the work can be really, really tremendous, or it can be really terrible. But it's really up to you to try to decide what your ethic is in doing that. As a painter, you can paint whatever you want and you can do whatever you want.
True.
But, you know, if you give it to, you could find a gallery if you're lucky and give it to them, and maybe they'll hang it up and maybe they won't. Different businesses.
Yeah, very true. You've done so many different projects throughout your career, but also at Pentagram. Is there one that you can pinpoint as, you know, something you learned the most from or was the most challenging project, and why?
There are different pivotal projects, and there are things that I did differently in each thing. Firstly, I have to talk about the public theater, okay, because it's a 27-year relationship and really, really unusual in the in our profession. I wrote a book about it that came out in the middle of the pandemic, so no one saw it.
What's the book called?
It's called 25 Years at the Public, A Love Story. And it was actually a gift book in the Times and the Wall Street Journal, so some people bought it. But it you know, no one was around to see it in a bookstore. The book is like a visual document of the things I made over 25 years. But the narrative is really about trying to learn how to do an identity. And by that, it's really about how the theater was run and how graphic design has to support that in a very specific way. When I first began designing for it, I designed a system by which they'd be recognizable, because all these ads had a very similar look and a similar book of typefaces, which is sort of classic in identity design. And then when I went to design the posters for the individual plays, the posters would change based on the play, but there was some kind of visual language that connected them. I did this for a couple of years, and then a play called Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk opened on Broadway. And I did a number of posters for them using the style of the public theater, but in this very street art sort of way with very big, loud expressions typography. And the the show opened at the Public Theater, so there was a big public logo on it when it opened the Public Theater. And that's actually the most famous poster. It's the yellow poster with all the crazy type and Saving Glover in the middle. And then it went to Broadway, and there was a poster that Richard Avedon shot, saying Brett Glover, and had typography over it with a white background, and that was hanging up on Broadway. And then there was a street graphic that was painted on the sidewalk, and then there was a water tower, and then there were a pile of billboards. And the promotions for that show went on for, I think, from the time it opened to the public till about 2000, 2001, until it closed. So there was this moment in time where these graphics were everywhere and people started imitating them. And when the show went to Broadway, nobody knew it was the public because the public wasn't on it anymore. It said at the Ambassador Theater, which was the theater that picked up the play. So something happened to my work that never happened before, was that the ownership of the poster was obliterated by it becoming a style. It's really bad if you develop an identity for somebody and their identity becomes a style of a city or just a lot of designers. It begins to lose any recognizability as that place. So in the middle of doing this series of posters for them, I had to stop and reconsider what I was doing. So I started designing posters that looked nothing like that. I did a couple of years of that where the type was serif typography and very quiet and more remote. But they were very undistinguished as posters. But then I began to realize that the Public Theater couldn't really gain any traction by the way I had been working with them. Not that I did anything that they didn't advocate. The expectation was that there would be season sort of announcements and there would be posters for individual plays. But unless you went to the Public Theater and saw the poster, you wouldn't see the poster because there was limited advertising for it. It didn't exist on the street like Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk. And that the only way you would know about it was already being loyal to the theater or being somebody in graphic design who looked in design annuals and saw the things win awards. But that winning awards has nothing to do with how the public receives anything. And you know that's true in every form of design, whether it's architecture, interior design, anything. Right. The awards are the thing of whatever a certain publication or organization determined, but that has nothing to do with public perception.
Right.
So that I realized I was not really doing the job I thought I should be doing for the Public Theater. And it took me about 15 or 16 years to really understand that and then to correct it. And I did, and it worked, and I feel great about it. It's also a better job because what I was doing wrong was they're not Broadway. They're a place. They're a place that has membership. They have a million programs.
Right.
The programs were all looking slightly different, not the same enough. The posters were all slightly different, not the same enough. Not enough to recognize them as one thing. So what I began doing was designing seasons. So a whole season of the Public Theater will look alike. And you'll recognize it as one thing, even though there are many different subcomponents to that season. And then at the end of the year, I'll change it and do it to the next season. And what happened as a result of it is the membership went up.
That's great.
Because, but I didn't do my job right for, 15 or 17 years, if you think about it. But the point of the book was really about that journey and what it was to discover that.
Interesting.
And not totally understanding what was going wrong with it. Yet I know for a fact that most designers don't do that kind of inquiry and they'll say, oh, well, this thing's going to last for years. No, they don't know that. You
right.
don't know. You don't know what the future is. For example, I began designing the posters as posters, thinking they're the most important thing. Nobody will see them now. They're technology. They exist on Instagram.
Yeah.
How do you know that 20 years ago? How do you know what you're making is really viable in that way, based on the way the culture changes and the technology changes so quickly and the way cities change? There's no way to know is the point.
I love that you wrote the book about that exploration, right? That it wasn't perfect. Most books are not most, but a lot of the books in design are about successes, and this is a success, but how you got there is the really interesting part of that story.
Well, it was also, I made a decision at one point. I mean, the public theater's had its financial highs and lows, and I made a decision to essentially take it on as pro bono because I felt I could do better work for them that way. You know, if you work for a not-for-profit organization and they pay you a certain amount of money, the expectation is a different relationship. And I like the relationship happened by accident because there was a period where they really hit the skids on in a couple of years. But then came back and offered me to pay me again. And I just turned it down because I didn't want to change the relationship. And that it's my R&D, you know, that my partner, Alan Fletcher, the same guy who did the thing at the restaurant, once said in a partner's meeting, that most organizations spend 25% of their profit on research and development. Graphic designers don't.
Right.
So that's how you do it.
Yep. Amazing. So you said pivotal projects. Was there another one besides this that you wanted to mention? Or?
Well, I think there was a series of them that came out of the public by accident, which were environmental graphics when I began becoming an environmental graphic designer, which was, I was 50. I mean, I was old in my career when I began doing it. And it was accidental. I worked on the public theater lobby with Jim Polshek. And I didn't know how to read an architect plan when I did that. I didn't have to do anything. It just started having me hang stuff up. And I remember going to somebody on Michael Bayrud's team and saying, I have to put a banner in this arch. How do I do that? And she said, you measure the arch and you make a drawing of the thing in the shape of the arch. And then you go to the manufacturer that makes the banner and you tell them what color you want it. And I said, that's it. And she said, yep.
Yeah, I can do this.
So that was the first thing I did. The next thing I did was a Photoshop rendering. This was my second big discovery. I had to do a design for the New Jersey Performing Arts Center. They wanted me to transform the building, and I thought I was going to transform it with banners, but it was still a crappy-looking building with a bunch of banners on it. So I painted the entire building. And this is where I made a major breakthrough discovery as an environmental graphic designer. I discovered that if you have a picture of a building and you make a Photoshop rendering that looks exactly like the way you want it to look, and you show it to your client and you cost it out and they can afford to do it, it will come out exactly like the Photoshop rendering. Where if you make a book jacket and they agree to it and you wait 6 months, you'll find it looks nothing like what you designed because they changed it so many times.
So actually your designs are happening.
No, I love that. I love that about environmental graphics. Sometimes you wait 4 years, but it looks exactly like a Photoshop rendering. I can show you examples. You would be surprised.
That's amazing. Was there another environmental graphics project that you left off of after that one?
Well, they started getting bigger and fancier. You know, I did a number of theaters. I think Bloomberg's headquarters was really fantastic because there was the money to experiment with materials, and we did these giant letter forms out of some kind of lucite plastic that are still in the place. If you go into Bloomberg, it's exactly like we designed it in 2005. It hasn't changed one iota of it. Really, and they really keep it beautifully. And then, you know, that was exciting because it was big and it had a digital component to it, and I loved working on it. But I also loved the Quad Cinema, which is a very small jewel box on 13th Street, where we really did all of the interior design as well as the graphics. And everything's made out of quads. Everything's cubed.
Is there part of the process you love the most? Is it the beginning? Is it the end creation? Is it the R&D? You know, what is it that you love about the process?
The invention, phase one. You know, when by phase one, I mean, sometimes it's two. It really depends on how you wrote the proposal. It's the phase where you make the schematic drawing of what it's going to look like, where you invent that. And that the second one that follows, it's usually good because you're correcting the imperfections in that. Then after that, I get bored.
How do you constantly stay inspired and creative? Where, you know, I know this is kind of a big kind of softball question, but where do you find inspiration? How do you keep on top of things, you know, and look for new sources of ideas?
Well, I have these really talented partners who scare the shit out of me. I mean, their work is so amazingly good, and I have to keep up. Yeah. You know, and that's what makes Pentagram good. I mean, that sort of healthy competition of looking around and seeing what other people are doing is, you know, inspiring and intimidating. It's always good to be a little bit scared.
Yeah, keeps you going. Yeah. And you mentioned doing more environmental graphics. And how do you continue to reinvent yourself or evolve? Or is that just the nature of the business, or, you know, the kind of quote unquote luck, you know, of people coming to you for different things?
Both. I mean, projects come in the door, and a lot of them are similar to other projects I've done before. And then every now and then I'll see one with something where I really don't even know if I'm qualified for the job. And those are usually the best projects.
Yep.
Because if you kind of don't know what you're doing, you're more likely to make a breakthrough. I feel that if you do something three times, you're an expert. And so the likelihood once you become an expert, you're not going to do very much invention because you've already discovered what not to do. The true breakthrough comes in being a little bit ignorant.
Yep.
Where you might ask a stupid question that may be an unusual way of seeing something.
Love that. And tell us one thing that people might not know about you.
I'm short.
How short is short?
Well, I think I'm shrinking.
Aren't we all?
I can't tell. You know, I have a very different mirror in New York City than I have in the country. And the country mirror is a bit, I look better in that mirror. I look taller and thinner. And in the New York City mirror, I look sort of short and dumpy. And I don't know how that happened. I don't remember looking that way in that mirror. And I don't know if it's that mirror against the other mirror, and I just got used to the other mirror, but something is definitely going on.
I think you need to rebuy the country mirror and bring it to the city.
You know, I have to say all my clothes still fit. And so nothing really happened. They're all fitting. They just don't look as good on me as a mirror. Maybe I didn't know. Maybe I didn't know that they didn't. I don't know. Something is changing. But, you know, that happens.
Oh my God, I love it. We always end this pod with a question that's the title of the podcast. So what has been or are your greatest lessons learned along the way?
I think that from the beginning, for me, I have tried both consciously and unconsciously to defy expectations. And that it started when I was young, when I was in a family where I felt like a misfit. And again, at school, and then again in my professional life, and that I'm really comfortable doing that I think it's that you will find yourselves always with some pre-existing belief of what you're supposed to be, and that you can defy that.
Love that so much. Thank you so much, Paula. It's been such a pleasure. You are amazing and quite a force. So it's been such a pleasure to sit here and listen to you today. Hope to meet you in real life soon.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Hospitality Design's What I've Learned. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find full episodes and transcripts at hospitalitydesign.com.